hoş geldiniz, which is welcome in Turkish. And you'll find out why I'm using Turkish. I'm using it appropriately for this episode. Welcome to another episode of Daddy Unscripted, the podcast. I am your podcast host and the creator, Tim Wheaton. I am very happy to have you all here tuning in. Not really tuning in, because you're not really tuning a radio, but clicking in, I don't know, listening in to another podcast episode. Today, I am sitting with Stephen A. Cook, not to be confused with any other Stephen Cooks, definitely not to be confused with Stephen A. Smith. This is Stephen A. Cook, who is the Eni Enrico Mattei Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And yes, I did read that from his Twitter page, which you can find him at Stephen A. Cook. That's Stephen with a V, not a PH. He is also an author. He has a new book coming out in June that you can get in pre-order in May, which is going to be called False Dawn. He also is a fellow podcaster with his friend Brad. They have a podcast titled The Amen Corner, which is A-M-E-N. And it's a pretty cool conversational podcast between the two of them, kind of musing. They're really fun to listen to, even for somebody who doesn't share a lot in common with some of their themes. They're from the East Coast. I'm from the West Coast. They're Yankees fans. I'm a Red Sox fan. Like, obviously, we don't meet eye to eye on some of these things, but between it all, or once the rubble settles on some of those things, we all love Van Halen, the three of us. My sit down with Stephen today comes out of my conversation with Bruce Mendelson, which was my previous episode. So again, big thanks to that machine that keeps on leading me to new fantastic people. So thank you, Bruce, for putting the two of us in touch. And I go into a good history of fatherhood and family and legacy and tradition with Stephen in regards to his own father, who passed away almost 9 years ago. It will be 9 years. Actually, by the time you hear this episode, it will have already been 9 years. But we had a very good conversation regarding legacy and family and tradition and fatherhood and being a son to a fantastic father and trying to live up to that high standard that we picked up from our own dads with Stephen. So it's a very good conversation to be had here. I had really planned on only doing one episode with him, but I think that I didn't expect it to go on as long as we did, because Stephen was going to be recording his own episode after this one, but we actually got some extra time in. Thank you, Stephen. So there will be two episodes. So this first episode may be a little bit shorter than I had thought, but this is mainly about our family situation, dads, being sons, being dads now, and there's a little bit of baseball talk in here. I'm not going to deny it. So without a bigger introduction, let's get right to the episode with myself and Stephen A. Cook. Here it is. We are here this morning, very excited to be here with Stephen. Do you go by Stephen A. Cook?
Yeah, because there's a lot of Stephen Cooks out there, including some bodybuilder dude. So I have to use my middle initial. There's a computer scientist at the University of Toronto that, like, the Egyptian press is always using his picture when talking about me. So yeah, I have to use the A to distinguish myself. It's strange. I also have a problem with Customs and Border Protection because my name is Stephen Cook.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So the bodybuilder apparently is on no-fly lists.
Well, there's someone with some combination of my three names who is not a fine, upstanding citizen. And as a result, every time I come into the country, not every time, every third or fourth time I come into the country, I get thrown into secondary screening and they rip my badge. Yeah, it's awful.
That happened to a friend of mine when we were trying to fly back from the Philippines, and he he had a fairly, his name's Michael Dean. And I mean, it's not that crazy of a name. And yeah, he needed a new pair of pants after all that was over. We'll just put it that way.
It's strange to me. I mean, one time I asked him about it, my name isn't, Abu Saif al-Jihadi. Yeah. As terrible as it is that, Muslims are being pulled aside, but literally it's because of the combination of my three names and the fact that I travel a lot and they just constantly messing with me at the border.
So we are here with Stephen A. Cook, not to be confused with any of the other Stephen Cooks. And I'll let you give your kind of title because I'm definitely not going to hit it on the head. So I'll let you do it.
Sure. I'm the ENI Enrico Mattei Senior Fellow from Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
When I first read that, I read it thinking of my only experience with that name is from a movie somewhere. And I was thinking, so is his name Stephen or is it Enrico? So I had to do a lot of research.
I will tell you that before I held this chair at the Council on Foreign Relations, I had another named fellowship. And from time to time, I would get emails from soon-to-be college graduates calling me Mr. Sabah rather than... It was amusing and actually quite sad that soon-to-be college graduates couldn't read carefully.
Right. You would say, you know what? You're actually... I'm sorry to say you're going to have one more year of college.
Right. You have to repeat your senior year of college.
Yeah. So I was told about you through my episode 26 guest, Bruce Mendelson, who quickly contacted you after we had our discussion and told me immediately that you would be one of the first people he would think of for me to talk with. So I'm very happy that you were on board with it, and I appreciate your time.
Oh, it's my absolute pleasure, and many thanks to Bruce for recommending me.
Yeah. He's a great guy. Yeah. So let's go into your family history. I know you kind of very briefly told me in one of our emails about your dad, but let's go back in and I will sit back and enjoy the story of your family history with regards to your parents and maybe grandparents, etc.
Thanks. It's fortuitous that we're doing this on February 25th because it was 9 years ago this coming Tuesday that my father passed away very suddenly. He was puttering around my parents' house on a Sunday morning, as he usually did, quite early, before my mom had gotten out of bed, and she heard him fall and went running and found him on the floor and couldn't get him off the floor and called the ambulance. And he was transported to the emergency room and then the intensive care unit. I was away. I was sorry. It's still 9 years later. It gets a little emotional to think about it. I was actually in Cairo, someplace that over the last decade or so has really become a second home to me. And this is, any kind of phone call like this is absolutely horrific. But to be, almost 6,000 miles away from home and you pick up the phone and you hear your mother's voice and you almost immediately know that there's something wrong. And she told me that I had to come home as soon as possible. So I made it home relatively quickly. I got a lot of help getting on the next flight out and arrived back in New York. And the last, thing I saw my father, he was on a breathing machine and we had a family meeting and decided that there was the best and most humane thing to do was to turn those machines off. And that was, I can't believe it, 9 years ago. It feels like a blink of an eye. Mm-hmm. What was my father was like Superman to me. I suppose that's the case with all little kids. He could do anything. He could fix anything. He could, he could fix my bike. He could pick me off the ground when I fell. He could make things right at school. And then as I got older, he could get me out of various and sundry jams. I remember I was part of my history was not funny at the time, but it's funny now. I was arrested in Washington, D.C. for disorderly conduct over arguing over a parking ticket with a Metropolitan Police officer when I was 24 years old. And now it's funny, but at the time it was quite scary. I mean, and of yeah. course, my personality is like that, to argue with a police officer. And I wasn't the spoiled kid who got out of everything, but it was absurd that I was arrested. And he kind of got me. And I had this image of him in my head and still do. But towards the end of his life, we had a much more tempestuous relationship. And I think it's because he was getting older. Now, he died relatively young. He died when he was 72. Mm-hmm. But I saw that he was slowing down. He had some health problems with high blood pressure, macular degeneration. And I could see how he was responding to it. And he was obviously worried about it. But it really scared the daylights out of me. And he also resisted help. And, you know, he had macular degeneration. And when my wife and I would be visiting my parents in New York, I'd say, "Hey, Dad, I'll drive." And he would get angry at me. And I, you know, in retrospect, I could understand why he got angry at me, because he must have been so frightened by his physical deterioration, or what he must have seen, you know, coming. And from my perspective at the time, it's like, geez, you know, if someone told me I would drive them around, I'd be more than happy about it. Mm-hmm. So we had this tension and this fighting. And of course we have very similar kind of personalities. We both run very, very hot. And that's one of the things that I remember from my childhood. And although, you know, look, he was, and in death, he seems wiser to me than he was in life. I mean, I resisted him, as all young men and teenagers will do with their fathers, I think. But when I think back on it, he was incredibly wise. And then every now and again, I'll just get stopped in my tracks and say, "Wow, you know, Daddy said that. And he was so right about that." And I was this young guy who thought that I knew everything, but he actually knew exactly what he was talking about. And I try to hold on to that. But he was really a special father who instilled in me the values that are obviously dear to me. I mean, both my parents, not to give my mom short shrift, but that I've thought about a lot when it comes to parenting my two little girls and the way I conduct myself professionally. A very, very strong and keen sense of justice, what's right, what's morally right. You know, one of his former law partners, associates, whatever you want to call it, said to me, she now lives in Paris, and whenever I make my way through there, we get together for dinner or a glass of wine. And she said to me once, "You know, your father was the most moral man I ever met in my life." Mm-hmm. And he once said to me, he said, "Look, if I didn't have any scruples, we'd be fabulously wealthy." So, you know, he was a really giant, and, you know, he could do everything. One of the differences, though, in terms of parenting is my father, and maybe this is a function of me as a kid or my children, my father taught me everything. He taught me how to swim. He taught me how to dive. He taught me how to ride a bike. He taught me how to play ping pong, how to throw a ball. And I sense he was incredibly, incredibly patient. I have no such luck with my daughters. And I think, one, you know, sometimes they resist Daddy just because. And I think the other thing is that I do not have it in me to well up the kind of patience that he had for my sister and me. I don't know where that came from. And he was an incredibly, incredibly busy person. I have these memories of being very, very little and him sitting in a chair in a three-piece suit, like he had come through the front door of the house, and I was little, I was already in bed, and he was in a three-piece suit, and of course, this is the 70s, so it was a three-piece suit, one of those fat ties, and he wore I remember during this period, he wore like a pocket watch across his the vest of his three-piece suit.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And he sat in one of the little chairs in my bedroom and read to me. And I can only imagine this was before he had dinner or anything like that. And he was always, you know, Johnny on the spot to give me a bath. I have very little recollection of my mom giving baths, but I have recollections of my dad. And he was incredibly good. I mentioned he had a law partner, but he was not part of a big firm. It was essentially him. And he had a bunch of associates. And now also, again, as an adult and, you know, I'm my, you know, mid to late 40s, I've got a mortgage, two car payments, saving for college and so on and so forth. He was a sole practitioner lawyer. He had to, he had, and my mom didn't, my mom had worked and then didn't work and then went back to school to get a another master's degree before she started working it. And he did this all on his own. And so it kind of blows my mind from time to time when I think about how he was able to do all of these things and be the attentive father he was. He never missed a Little League game, a soccer game. He never, ever missed any of that stuff unless it was like a high school soccer game on a Wednesday at 4 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
I travel, I write, I do things that sometimes are not as scheduled. And I'm forever guilty knowing that my father never missed those games, that I, there are Saturdays where I don't make it to soccer and Sundays I don't make it to softball, and that I've missed a parent's day at ballet and stuff. And those things, they bother me. They make me feel bad. And it, not only because I think the girls obviously want to be there, but I just can't sometimes figure out how he was able to manage it, because I just feel sometimes overwhelmed by life that way. So as far as, you know, you asked about my family history, I don't really know my father's father. He died when I was 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But from what my mom tells me, my dad talked about him. My dad and my grandfather were quite close, but I don't remember long conversations with my father about my grandfather. But my mother always talked about what a charming and lovely and interesting man he was. My father had a lot of that charm. He also had an explosive temper. I remember that growing up. And I still have it. I have it. It's not as bad. And I've tried to keep it under control. But my father had a lot of that charm as well. But he, again, was also, I think he had some anger towards his mother and his father that he hadn't worked out. And that was, I think, part of the reason why he had an explosive temper. Mm-hmm. I think it also fit the fact that he was a lawyer and a litigator. He liked the fight. As my sister said, at his funeral, he fought the good fight. He fought the bad fight, and he often fought the fight that didn't need to be fought at all. So there, he was a complicated, but in my mind, and I don't think I'm just because we're coming up on 9 years after his death, I don't think I'm romanticizing it. I've gone kind of full circle. He was a giant when I was 4 and 5 years old, and now he's a giant again when I'm 48 years old. The very sad thing is that he's not around for me to hear that.
Right.
And I'm not sure that if he was here, I would have that kind of perspective. We'd probably be having a tempestuous relationship, because at this point he would be, you know, 80 years old and probably having more physical and health problems. And that would be freaking me out more, which would be manifesting itself more in this kind of edgy anger and tempestuous relationship we had.
Yeah. It's funny because I have a similar kind of situation with my dad, who same boat. And just like you said, I know a lot of kids have that feeling about their dads. And like when you said that, I kind of do feel, I don't like saying it this way, but I kind of do feel badly for the kids who don't right. look at their dad with that superhero or even like ability to do all these things kind of look in their eye. Like I just can't imagine
being, that must be like, right.
Yeah, like being so just not, I don't know, I respected or whatever you would say, but my dad is one of those guys who people loved, and he was a pastor of a church, and he also was a veterinarian, so he was helping people all the time. You know, I remember when I was a kid, so many times that people would be calling for whether it was spiritual help or animal help, and right. He would be, you know, leaving us shortly after dinner or whatever to take care of something for somebody. And that was always a bummer when he left. But now I think because when I see people who knew him, and my voice is similar to my dad's, I look a lot like my dad did. And so people who knew him, it's not uncommon for them to start talking with me and just to already see tears well up in their eyes because of how much I'm reminding them of him. And wow, they usually,
special.
Yeah. And they talk about, you know, what a great guy he was, and that he was, you know, somebody who completely changed their lives. And my dad passed away in 1990. Mm-hmm. So it's been a much longer time for me, but it's still, you know, I have that outlook of him. I think his physical depreciation went fairly rapidly. He died of brain cancer, and his symptoms started probably in January of the year that he died in November. So it was kind of fast, but those last 5 months, I would say, were a decline to about as low as it can go. You know, I mean, to him being in a wheelchair and not being able to do anything, you know, having to bathe him and take care of him after he went to the bathroom and that kind of stuff. And the humility that I'm sure he had to like choke down as hard as you can choke that down as a father. And you know, seeing him in the hospital at the end, and it was one of those things that I really, really struggled with that, especially as a 17-year-old at the time.
I can't even imagine. I cannot even imagine.
So, but now, you know, I definitely hold him in that same esteem that I did all my life, and not all of my thoughts go back to that time, obviously, and it is something that I am consciously thinking of, not every minute as I'm parenting, but thinking about, you know, his legacy and who he was, not only to our family and to my mom and to us kids, but to other people as well. So I definitely, that resonates with me when you talk about thinking about the games that you're missing or whatever. And it's good to have that bar, but it also can be a struggle to try to be what they were.
That's exactly right. But you know, there's two things that you said just now that really struck me in relation to my own relationship with my father. One is, you know, you're this situation that you describe at the end of your father's life just is, I just can't even imagine that. I can't imagine how my father would have handled that. And I can't imagine how I would have. I mean, I probably, honestly, I might have run away to be completely. Mm-hmm. I was so, again, he was not as healthy, but he was not by any, there was no hint. The night before I left on this trip to Egypt, I said to my mom, he doesn't look well. He needs to go to the doctor. There was really no hint that he was going to literally, you know, drop dead.
Right.
And two of his closest buddies said to me when after the funeral, I said, you know, Stephen, it was a good death. Just imagine your father surviving a stroke, what that would have been like for him, who was really full of life, and for everybody around him. And that's true. So I can't imagine what you and your family went through. And in a way, it's hard to say it this way, but I'm thankful for that quote unquote good death, The other thing, but I think more important, is the way in which your father touched people's lives. I mean, he spent his life caring for people, caring for their animals, but also caring for people. And by caring for their animals, it was caring for people too. That's extraordinarily special. And no wonder why people are emotional when they see you and they speak with you. I've had an experience. I look somewhat like my dad. I took a picture with my nephew yesterday, and we looked at it. I was like, geez, I look exactly like my father. But that's not what tripped people up. I have a bunch of friends from college who have, over the years, said to me, "You have no idea the impact that your father had on my life." Whoa. You know, one of my buddies essentially lived with my family during a Christmas break because things weren't great with his family. And when my father died, he flew in. The only flights he could get were same day flights. He flew back and forth to San Francisco just to go to my father's funeral. An old girlfriend remarked to me recently, I think I sent her an email to wish her well or something. And I said, you know, please send my regards to your parents. And she said, you know, I was thinking a lot about your dad recently, and he had such an impact on my life. And this has happened with my sister and friends of hers from college or high school or wherever. And the two people who've reached out to me, those aren't the only two. And I'm going to see these two people in the coming months. As you know, I have a book coming out. I'm going to be going out on book tour, and I'm going to be in the cities where these people, I need to set aside time. And I've already told them, because I need to hear more about this from them. What it was like not to be Michael Cook's son and daughter, but what kind of impact he had on those people's lives. It really, really interesting to me. And also, not just interesting from an intellectual level, but something that I want to impart to my daughters. My older daughter was 2.5 when he died, 3, and my not even 3. And my little one wasn't even born. So she has no memory.
Yeah, that's with my kids, didn't even come close. I have an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old. So, you know, that was part of what kind of brought this whole podcast and before that blog into being, was partially me kind of wanting to capture that in my own family. And I still want to sit, unfortunately, you know, I can't do an episode with my dad, but I kind of want to sit down with my mom and kind of make an episode about my dad out of conversations with my mom and maybe some of my siblings and some other people. But
it sounds really cool, actually.
I want to capture this and document it. And then it became a thing where I wanted to help others do that. And I don't know, you know, out of the people that I've sat with, I don't know how many of them have their kids or family members listening to these, but a lot of these stories are going back to those times that don't have the documentation of their family life going on like we do today. And so,
right,
especially, you know, for me or for you, my dad was born in 29, my mom was born in 31. And, you know, one of the things, because I also do photography and I talk with...
I looked at beautiful stuff, your photography.
Oh, thank you. And, you know, we have that documentation of everything now. And right. So I wanted to open this up for other people, and as well as to learn things for myself and for the listeners of these relationships, and... hopefully for the men that are listening that are dads or are new dads that are thinking about the legacy that they are potentially building with their kids. And like you are very astutely bringing up, with all of these other people that they are coming into contact with.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's that kind of documentation thing is so incredibly important. Every year on, and this is just one little thing, but it bothers me. Every year on the anniversary of my father's death, my sister and I, you know, post some photos of him. My sister often will post, write something about him. I just post the photos of him, just one on Facebook. I know he was quite obviously he was important to me, but I know he was important to a lot of my friends. So I post the photo. And again, I'm still trying to work through that and want to understand it better. But I'm finding as the years have gone on, I'm starting to run out of photos of him because he was always the guy behind the camera.
Mm-hmm.
We must have in my parents' basement 10,000 slides that he took, which is really a documentation of our life. Now, who has slides? I don't even think the machine he has that's still in my parents' basement even works. But so we're going to have to do something with it. And I think my mom, my sister, we just haven't been able to deal with it. But this is a documentation of his life, our lives that I very much would like for us to go through. And I think even while he was alive, sometimes he would get frustrated with things. And I remember my mom telling a story where they were looking through slides and maybe they had just been on a trip. They had traveled all over the world. My parents were not wealthy. Solidly upper middle class. You know, my father paid for, you know, college out of his checking account and so on and so forth. Of course, those were the days when college didn't cost $65,000 a year.
Yeah.
But, you know, my mom grew up in a 3-room apartment in the Bronx. My father also grew up in the Bronx. His family was, you know, slightly better off and whatever. But they really made a life for themselves, you know, kind of the American dream. They moved from the city, they moved to the suburbs. And, you know, my father was a professional. My mom was a professional. They drove nice cars and they traveled. And she tells this story about how they were looking at slides. I don't think it must not have been from one of their European trips, but something, and he was lamenting something. And she said to him, have some perspective, think about how successful a life you've actually had. And she went through all of those things. And one of the things that I think is important in having that documentation is understanding from whence we have come and the life that they made together and what he was able to do coming from extremely modest backgrounds. And to date, you know, we have the stories. My sister knows the stories and the connections better than I do. But to have that kind of photographic kind of documentation of my father's life and along with my mom, I think is incredibly important. I remember after he died, I got it in my head that I was going to take we had the video camera. You know, remember everybody had those video cameras 10 years ago before the iPhones took, you know, before the iPhone and before the iPhone took great video. And I was going to go to the important people in my father's life and just have them talk to me about him. Of course, mm-hmm. you know, little kids, work, whatever. I never got around to doing it. And now I look forward to somehow taking these slides, turning them into photos if they are still in good condition, so that we have some sort of documentation. I also remember my mom going through his papers, and I think she still is. And he was extremely creative. You know, he was a lawyer, but he would have been a fantastic journalist. He was an English major in college, and he wrote beautifully. And she's kept, actually, you know, a lot of the legal papers she found that she doesn't need. They need to be shredded and so on and so forth. But she's been going through things very, very carefully, because there is some really fantastic work, letters and stuff that he wrote, letters to members of Congress, Senate, and so on, where people actually responded. And so this kind of correspondence. And I remember we were in the car together, and my mom was driving, and the tears coming down my cheeks and saying, please, please, please save all of that, because I need for there to be evidence of his existence in this world,
mm-hmm.
other than a gravestone. And so that hits me really, the photographs, the papers, those things hit me really, really hard, because he was so important to me. And I think, as I've implied, there is this fear and this feeling that I don't necessarily measure up on the fatherhood scale. He's a bar to strive towards, which I don't think I ever really meet. But that he shouldn't be lost in the ether. It's enough that my little one, my 8-year-old, never met him. So I think that as my wife and I get older, for my daughters to have a sense of our history, to have not only the photographs, but also the papers, and especially the fun stuff that he did. I mean, he was a goofball too. Mm-hmm. To have that kind of stuff. I mean, you're talking about this documentation and the photographing of, you know, the one photograph of your mom when she was pregnant, and you're suggesting to your clients that maternity photos are important. They are. They're incredibly important.
Yeah. Something that I think about a lot too, because it's, you know, the times that I've told my 8-year-old about her papo, and, you know, she'll listen and she'll take it in. And I know, I keep thinking, you're 10 to 20 years off from really caring about this. You know, it's that reminder and kind of continuing to sow the little seeds for when they are at that point where they are really like, okay, I want to know about who my grandparents were and who my great grandparents were. And that's when, you know, that collection becomes that much more important, that they are able to easily tap into and make some sense of, you know, because if it's very doomy gloomy, and I think about this stuff, and it doesn't mean I'm thinking about my death all the time, but, you know, if I have this box of stuff of my dad's in my garage, and I don't live to tell that story to my kids are doing what we were maybe doing with our grandparents' stuff and picking through it and saying, I have no idea what this is.
Right.
And it looks cool, but I don't, you know, and it could be this, it could be that infamous pocket watch from Pulp Fiction, you know, that came over in Christopher Walken's dad's
butt.
Yeah.
That is an unbelievable scene. I love.
Yeah. But, you know, there are these things that we don't know about, or we don't document what that importance of it is. And, you know, like I have tapes. These have been like one of the big things for me of my dad, because they recorded a tape of the church services when he was pastor. And
oh wow,
this is dating back to, you know, his church started back in the 70s in Laguna Beach, where I was, which is my hometown. And so it was it was during the Jesus movement, and it was during, you know, the kind of near the end of the hippie movement. And so there were a lot of hippies and fishermen in the church, and it started out, and they would meet like literally in the woods and just kind of sit around and talk and sing and read the Bible and whatever. And then eventually it became a church, and I had this big group of tapes, which unfortunately I think one of my brothers tossed when we downsized my mom's home. And so I lost this big section, but I was able to procure some from one of the other pastors in the church somewhat recently. And so I have at least a sizable amount of tapes from, like,
have you listened to them?
Yes. And I'm actually looking at, here at my desk, I have two of them. And, because I was going through the process of transitioning them to digital. Yeah. And it's been one of those things that I've wanted to do for these other people that he meant something to, and create either a website, or, you know, lately I've been thinking a podcast might be the easier thing for them to tap into and make each tape its own episode.
Right. Right.
But it's a huge process. I mean, it's,
yeah,
that is the ultimate of time sucks. Like, having to put this tape in, because you have to do it in real time. So you're having to let this thing run for an hour and a half. and flip the tape and do all of that. But
let me ask you a question, if only for my own kind of, what's it going to look like for me down the road? Your father passed away, what, 27, 26 years ago?
Yeah.
My dad passed away 9 years ago, and I just had this experience. In early January was one of my nephew's bar mitzvahs. And the kind of thing that the big thing they do at bar mitzvahs these days is they have what's called a montage. It's like, this is your life, 13-year-old. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of documents your life. It's set to music and so on and so forth. And so it was time for the montage at my nephew's bar mitzvah. And it starts, and the first thing you see is a video of my father holding my nephew within, you know, minutes after he was born. And it's a video and he's talking.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
That was the first, I have not seen video or heard his voice since I called and said, okay, I'm getting on the plane in, you know, late February 2008. I'll mm-hmm. talk to everybody when I come back, and spoke to him. And he said, I love you. And that was it. But I have not, and it was like he was in the room again. And it was just, whoa, we had a great time that night. But that moment, it caught me and kind of stopped me in my tracks. And when you listen to those recordings of your dad, now it's been, you know, longer. Does that still happen to you? I mean, it's.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It was like being in the room. He was there. It wasn't even like a ghost, you know, he was there.
Right. And the first time was, gosh, it wasn't too much longer after he had died that I was kind of going through and listening to them. And then there was a long gap, and it was maybe 2 years ago that I heard it again. And so it was easily a 10 to 15 year gap between me hearing his voice, and it stops time.
Yeah.
You know, it just stops time. It kind of cores you out, and it's that breath between for me, it was the elongated breath between shock of something and wanting to just sit in the corner and suck your thumb and cry, basically, right. You know,
right.
And it was that during the whole thing, you know, and then eventually, like, I think once I stopped it, the times that I kind of sat and thought about it, I would cry. But otherwise, it was just like it was time stopping. I don't know how else to describe that. So,
yeah.
And that's, I don't think that goes away, and I don't want it to. You know, I've talked with some other guys who have lost their dads, and I've, you know, obviously I'm not thinking about him every single day when I wake up, and it's not as raw as the beginning, but I don't want the welling up of tears when I'm thinking or talking about him to ever be something to stop. And I'm glad that emotional rawness is always barely scabbed over. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's a good point. I'm not sure I ever want to get used to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know where to take it from there.
Yeah. This is heavy. This is a little different from my own podcast, I have to tell you.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm used to hearing you guys laughing so much, and, we're definitely in a different
direction. Yeah. Yeah. Our podcast for your listeners, which we call the Amen Corner, is a, it basically, the underlying theme of it is, how did we get here? We still think of each other as, you know, 15, 16-year-old guys, and now we're, you know, slouching towards middle age. Given the politics of the country, I think we've moved a little bit away from that in order to talk about politics. Both Brad and I are quite interested in politics and international affairs, and so we call ourselves the conscience of the nation, and we've been deconstructing what's going on in the country, interspersed with a lot of tremendous laughter, some clean humor, some not so clean humor. But it's actually rather cathartic. Brad also lost his father not that long after my father died. And we've had conversations about this. And, you know, the tagline of our podcast is, you know, what does, you know, fatherhood, Judaism, Israel, the Yankees, and Van Halen have to do with each other? And it says everything. Find out now. Everything. And it really does. It really does.
I remember reading that off the bat. I think that was one of the first things that I read after Bruce mentioned you. And I may have read it out loud to my friend and coworker who I live a pretty good life at my job. My brother is a veterinarian who obviously followed in my dad's footsteps. Right. And I am the office manager of his animal hospital. So I get to see my brother every day and work with him. And my friend one of my best friends since 1992 or three, he and I share an office and we get to, you know, we have a lot of work that we have to do, but we also get to joke around with each other all day and, you know, listen to music, and we listen to quite a bit of Van Halen here in our office.
Love it.
And I am surrounded by all of my Red Sox memorabilia. So when I read that out loud to him, he said, "Oh, you're never going to be able to talk with that guy."
You know, my dad, to bring this back to this theme, my dad grew up six blocks from Yankee Stadium.
Oh, wow.
So I am essentially genetically encoded to be a Yankees fan. And when you go into my parents' basement, which was my father's man cave before that awful term was ever created, there are files and files and files of Yankee memorabilia in kind of plastic sleeves. Mm-hmm. Things that, you know, the Yankees newsletter from 1940, whatever.
Wow.
I have seats from the original Yankee Stadium. You know, they sold them off when they built the new stadium across the street in the Bronx.
Yeah.
But when they refurbished the original stadium in the mid-1970s, he had a friend who was an engineer who was working on the project who said, "Oh, why don't you come to the Bronx and you can pick out some seats because we're switching out the seats." And I remember being freezing cold day and sitting in the back seat of my father's Chevy with my sister and going to the Bronx and picking out stadium seats. My sister now has two. I have two. I remember my father, he always wanted one of the original ticket booths, but I don't think he could ever figure out how to get it to our house. I think my mom probably would not have been happy with a ticket booth in her backyard.
Right. Wow. That would be amazing. But
the Red Sox, you're from California. Yeah. No,
I know. It's a very long story. And the basis of it really is that I loved rooting against my dad. And my dad was a hometown fan. You know, he loved the Dodgers. He loved the Angels. He actually loved the Dodgers from when they were in Brooklyn, which is kind of funny that, and good for him that they moved out here to LA. But he loved all of the local teams, loved the Lakers, and so I loved the Celtics.
That's funny.
And so I basically just went against him in that.
It's interesting, that dynamic. My sister, who has two boys, is married to a guy from Boston, and they live in New York, but my nephews are all, you know, New England sports fans. And I married a woman from Boston. It's like Sunni and Shia here, you know. But actually, Sunni and Shia get along a lot better than Yankee fans and Red Sox fans, as you probably know. So it makes for an interesting dynamic. I know my older nephew used to give my father a hard time about the Yankees and stuff like that. I think it was hard for my father to contain himself.
I always
Pops, the Yankees suck.
I tell everybody, though, that if I'm not having a conversation about baseball with a fellow Red Sox fan, I would want to have a conversation with a Yankees fan, because
Right.
Some of my best baseball talks have been with Yankee fans.
Right, because, you know, Yankee, with both franchises, there is that steeped in tradition. There's this desire to be deeply knowledgeable about the team. And then people translate that into thinking that they're deeply knowledgeable about the game and so on and so forth. It does make for some interesting conversations about who's a better shortstop, who's a better center fielder. And so I remember the one and only time I went to Fenway Park, my father-in-law took me, and it was a freezing day in May. I think I was wearing like a ski jacket, maybe even ski pants. I mean, this was May in New England. And they have their mascot, the Green Monster, goes up and down and high fives people.
Yeah, Wally.
Wally the Green Monster. And I was sitting on the edge, on the aisle, and he came up to high-five me, and I motioned him to get closer to me, you know, where the mouth is. That's where the guy behind the thing is. And I said,
"Yeah,
my name is Bucky Dent." And he started pounding on me. It was really funny.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was great. It was pretty cool.
So thank you again for taking time out on your Saturday morning, and possibly apologies to Brad if I delayed you guys at all.
That's okay. He'll get over it, I'm sure.
Okay, and there you have it. The first of two episodes with Stephen A. Cook, and I'm very happy that I was able to sit down and talk with him about all of these things today. Again, you can find him on Twitter at Stephen A. Cook. That's Stephen with a V. And make sure you have that A in there, or you're going to get into some, either a bodybuilder's account or somebody else's account. So make sure that it's Stephen A. Cook with a V. And you can find his blog and everything else he has connected there. You also find the connection to his previous books that he wrote and the one that is going to be coming out pretty soon in May for pre-order or June for its official release, called False Dawn. So again, thank you very much for being a part of this, Stephen. And you can find Daddy Unscripted as well on Twitter, Daddy Unscripted. You can find us on Facebook, on Instagram. You can send me an email at daddyunscripted@gmail.com and help keep these fantastic guests coming in, and these people that I have no connection to but actually now do. I love that. I love meeting these great people that I never would have been connected to otherwise. So again, big thanks to the world of Twitter that really has kind of pushed a lot of this along outside of my own bubble of people that I know. So make sure you send in those emails. You guys, I would love to get a review or a rating on iTunes from you. You can find the Daddy Unscripted podcast also on Google Play. We are on Stitcher Radio. You can go to the website, daddyunscripted.com, and find some of the older blog posts. And on the blog post there, I will have links directly to all things Stephen, so you'll be able to find them there as well. So make sure you check out that next episode, which should be out in a week or two, but it'll probably be 1 week before I release that second episode with Stephen A. Cook. So thanks again for listening, you guys. Make sure you tell your friends and family about this cool Daddy Unscripted podcast that isn't just for dads. There's a lot of good stuff in here, I think, for other people as well. So thank you for spreading that around, and keep an eye out for that next episode.